वाहिगुरु जी का खालसा, वाहिगुरु जी की फतेह। सो
वाहिगुरु जी का खालसा, वाहिगुरु जी की फतेह।
विद मी टुडे आई हैव सरदार गुरप्रीत सिंह जी ऑफ द सिख सखी ब्लॉग स्पॉट, एंड यू आल्सो हैव अ ब्लॉग द इंसाइसिव पेन ऑन व्हिच यू राइट वेरी थॉट प्रोवोकिंग आर्टिकल्स ऑन सिखी। एंड कैन यू प्लीज इंट्रोड्यूस योरसेल्फ अ लिटिल बिट फॉर अस?
ओके, सो वी हैव टू स्टार्ट अगेन, हाँ?
Yes, unfortunately, we had the technical difficulty before, but just a brief introduction.
Okay. My name is Gurpreet Singh, as he as you mentioned, and I'm born and brought up in Punjab, Jalandhar, and did my graduation from Amritsar and post graduation in business administration from Rohtak, and then my throughout career is with the FMCG companies, and in sales and distribution, and right now I'm working with a food company in Bahrain. But at the same time, I have a passion towards Sikh history, Sikh literature, and to do some research. As you mentioned, that I have my sikhsakhi.com blog, but I started my first project was of a mobile application by the name of Sakhi, SAAKHI. Which is available on Android and iPhone. And in these Sakhis, I've made a point that at the end of every Sakhi, I've put a moral of the story. It is in audio format. It's a short stories. And at the end of every short story, I've mentioned a moral of the story relating it to the current scenario. And through that process, I realized that I need to speak up more on the danger from where we need our society to be aware of, and that is Brahmanism. So I've written a book by the name Sole Enemy of a Sikh, Brahmanism. In English and Punjabi, it is Sikh da Ikko Vairi Brahmanwa.
Now, we mentioned Brahmanism down here, and that is not something which is particularly targeting Brahmins as individuals or as a community, but the ideology which places them at the top of what we traditionally call the caste hierarchy in India.
Exactly. So it is not with any community. It is okay, and we can never be, Sikhs can never be against any community. Realizing that the bani of Brahmins are already there in Guru Granth Sahib. So,
So when we talk about Brahmanism now, of course, there's the Aryan invasion, I guess, history, which is established as a fact now. Aryans come along, they conquer most of India, state sport, and through state sport, the Aryan government obviously divides society into four parts now. I guess in the European sense, you have guilds, which is that you're a merchant, you're a carpenter, you're a soldier. But there is a bit of equality down there because humans as individuals are allowed to change from one profession to another eventually. But in India, if you're born into a particular caste, you're stuck into that caste for the rest of your life. You can't really change from one caste-based occupation to another without any repercussions being visited upon you.
Yeah, so that is because in India, the kind of casteism that is prevalent, that has got approval from the religion. So it has given, it is approved by religious authority, and so it has become a sacred for the people. That's the major difference between the casteism around the world and the casteism in India.
In India. Now, the theory of reincarnation, does that also act as a weapon for casteism, that if you're born into a particular caste, it's due to your past karma, past life?
You are right, it is definitely a very strong weapon. to establish this. Again, because as we mentioned that it has been given a religious approval, so this theory of reincarnation further reinforces this.
And I guess one thing I'd like to mention down here for the listeners as well, and I guess you would probably be aware of this, there is quite a interesting book, Sikhism Under Brahminical Siege, which was published in Canada in the late 90s, I believe. I have a copy of that book at home, but which isn't with me at the moment. Now, the author in there, if I remember correctly, Dr. Gurbakhsh Singh mentions an incident, and this is that we know that Bhakt Ravi Das Ji refused to wear the janeu. Whenever we mention caste, Bhakt Ravi Das Ji comes up. And what I actually meant was that Bhakt Ravi Das refused to honor the janeu. He said that the janeu is worthless. He couldn't wear the janeu because he wasn't a Brahmin. But it's amazing, isn't it, how the Brahminical writers who came into Sikhi in around the Sikh Raj era, Khalsa Raj era, they fabricated this tale that Bhakt Ravi Das wore a janeu, and the Brahmins tried punishing him because he was a low caste, and he showed them a vision of his past life in which he was a high caste Brahmin who made a transgression, and he was born as a low caste Chamar. Now, can you see the pattern down here, how it's the caste theory once again, that the low caste person born as a low caste has done some sin in his life, so in his past life. So you can see the pattern down here, how caste always finds that way to attack even figures which were opposed to caste in the first place. And is this a strategy? Is this a intellectual strategy to defend itself?
It is used as a strategy, no doubt. And one more on a lighter tone. See, the theory of reincarnation says that it means that most of the people, those who are born in India, we know that it's hell of malnutrition, poverty, the human so low. This means that people, those who are have done sins in America, Canada, they are reborn in India, right? So they are the countries where people of good karma of their previous birth get birth in Western countries, and the country where there's a land of gods, we call it, is actually where there's a number of ailments going on, and people are in very happiness index is so low. So just on a lighter tone.
No, I understand. I fully agree with that, and I guess our listeners would also agree with that. I mean, we call India Tharam, the Jameen Tharam, the Marg. We call it a lot of things. You know that it's a Dharmic land. That's where Tharam began from. That's where Tharam was born. But in reality, the whole thing is quite different, because if you look at it from a closer perspective, you realize that there is so much suffering, so much, I guess, so much incompetency down there in society. You're left wondering that, if you do good in India, you will probably be reborn as an American or a Canadian or Australian. And if you do bad in these countries, you're probably going to be reborn as an Indian. So what's there to be proud of, your national identity? And I guess at the moment, society in India hasn't reached that point, but it will eventually reach that point, as long as, I guess, the words of Baba Nanak Gurbani, the words of Bhakt Ravi Das and Kabir, they aren't actually, made universal for people down there to live their lives by, that there is no such thing as reincarnation, in the sense that if you do bad, you're going to be reborn as a lower caste, or if you do good, you're going to be reborn as a higher caste. These are just superficial ideas, superficial, I guess, for a better want of term, superficial temptations to keep you in check. So that brings us to another part. So we have the caste system, which is a form of control. So is it true to say that the Shudra, the lower caste, the lowest of the low, that caste is in more of a majority, and it's to keep them in check that the higher castes have imposed the caste system on them?
Obviously, this is a very important point that the Shudras will always be in a majority. they are in majority, and the point is to control the majority population. So there are castes which are selected, and you will see that these people, the majority, will historically have been in the villages. Even still date, when there's a lot of urbanization, the 60% of Indian population is in villages. But in earlier times, obviously the ratio would have been much more. So the people, those who are in cities, they were into trading, they were into bureaucracy, they were into jobs and all those. So I think that what the Varna Vastha has done, they have selected those castes and put them into Khatri, Vaish, and all the people, those who are into majority, those who are skilled labor, those who are with farming, they have put it into Shudra. Because, ultimately they are the people, those who are doing, that needs to be controlled, because otherwise the majority will decide the rule, but this should not happen. So they need to control through minority.
And I guess one more question down here is that, so we have a Shudra who's a farmer. This is something we discussed a while back in one of our older episodes last year on Guru Hargobind Sahib Ji and the use of force and Sakhi. Now, we have Guru Nanak, Baba Nanak, and Baba Nanak is born into a Khatri family. By trade, they're entrepreneurs. They also have a history of being warriors, but Baba Nanak leaves everything and becomes a farmer. So first of all, as we will get to the point, he refuses the Janyu, which is a tantamount to refusing entry into the caste system, because he is born in one of the upper castes. On the other hand, he becomes a farmer, which is his second blow against the caste system. And the irony here is that the Shudra produces the vegetables which the higher castes consume, but the Shudra, on account of being a farmer, is treated as a slave, as someone with bad karma. Isn't that a bit ironic for whoever designed the caste system? Is this a loophole? Is this a contradiction? Or is this something by intent, that the higher castes will always depend on the lower castes, but they will also mistreat the lower castes?
Yeah, when a religious approval is given, so it becomes very easy to build the narratives. You're right. In a way, the higher castes, the so-called higher castes, are always dependent on the labor, on the farming of the lower castes. You can relate this with the conversation that the Guru Nanak had with yogis. Okay, so what the yogis did? The yogis says that they are more enlightened and they are of a higher stature because they have left the family life, right? And so that's why they are effect. So, but Guru Nanak said that you go and beg your food from the grasth. So how can you be higher if you're eating a food from a grasthi? So, right? So this, so these things are challenged in Gurbani a number of times. So all those, the religious narratives which were going on in the society. One was by the yogis, the another was by the Brahmins, and they all rely on that they have become more pure or of a higher stature because of doing this and this. But Guru Nanak challenged everything, that see, this is not a method, or this cannot be true.
So when we come down to opposition to caste, so we have established that this is the caste system. It's quite a pernicious system of control. It controls the majority by, you know, rendering it intellectually, mentally, psychologically, and even physically impotent. So let's come down to the fact that there is opposition to caste. You know, many people start opposing it. Many individuals take the risk. We have Bhakt, Kabir Bhakt, Ravidas Bhakt, Surdas Bhakt, Ramananda Jayadev, all the Pandra Bhakt, Gurbani, who oppose the caste system, who say, look, people as humans have potential. Why are we trying to constrain that in the name of religion? Can you explain the risk they ran, how risky that, even when Baba Nanak refused the Janyu, even when he became a farmer, can you explain the sort of risks they confronted at the time by doing this?
You see, this challenge is full of risks, and till date it is so. Because there is an ideology which is completely based on this. So when you have challenged that, that means you're challenging their existence. You're challenging the existence of Brahmanism. If you remove these things, you remove the mythology, you remove, you discard the caste system, then what is left in this Brahmanism? Today we call it Sanatan Dharam. What else is there? So two are fighting for their existence, and their existence is dependent on suppression of these voices. So it is a serious confrontation. It was there in earlier times. It is there even in 21st century.
I guess I asked that question because it would allow our listeners to better appreciate that Baba Nanak refusing the Janyu was not as simple as holding up his hand and saying, look, I refuse. He ran quite a brutal risk. On one hand, we have the Bhakts who I would say were confirmed into their castes. Bhakt Ravidas was born into the Chumar caste. He became a cobbler. Kabir was born into a Jalaha caste. He became a weaver. In a way, they confirmed to the caste expectation of their society, of their birth. But you have Baba Nanak who, rather than become what a Khatri was expected to become, becomes a farmer.
Yeah.
And I guess that thought crime, that pattern of thought Baba Nanak had, that now I need to actually go out and spread this castelessness, I need to confront people. The Baba Nanak we have today holds up his hand, stops a rock, stops a storm, brings a storm, raises the dead. In reality, that wasn't Baba Nanak. Baba Nanak was an individual with a lot of valor, a lot of bravery, a lot of courage. And I guess when we are talking about Baba Nanak confronting caste, there would surely have been attempts made on his life, made on his very existence, to silence him.
Very true. Yeah.
And over time, it seems we have, all these have been erased from Sikh history. So one thing I would like to ask you here is that we know how Buddhism was vanquished from the subcontinent. In a way, are we seeing that with Sikhi today as well, that, borrowing your expression, that Brahminical opportunists would have converted to Sikhi when Sikhs were politically and socially prominent and started altering Sikhi from within to be able to survive?
This has been right from the Guru Nanak. If you see, there have been number of attacks, recorded attacks on gurus. So often these attacks are dismissed as a family feud, right? But it is not. Like,
yes.
Like the Prithi Chand has aligned with Birbal, the people, those who attacked on Guru Nanak, Guru Tegh Bahadur. They were aligned with the people sitting with Aurangzeb. Those who are the Ram Rai, we know that he was blessed with land, prime land in Dehradun. So these were not the family feuds. Yes, the fault lines were found, and these people had aligned with the rulers of the land, and they were exploited to disrupt this movement. So right from the Guru's time, it has been there, and even Today, the same thing is happening. So, side by side, we need to contemplate on the issues so that we are aware of the developments, the things that is happening, why they are happening in this way.
And isn't it ironic? I mean, if you look at some examples from history, recent research in our history, Pahari Raja, yep. 22 of them, we knew that, you know, when Aurangzeb, when the Mughals came along, when India became an Islamic conquest, surely the Muslims would have said to themselves, the Muslim rulers, that, look, they've got a caste system. Why should we get rid of it? Because it allows us to easily control them anyway. It's just a change of the power that, you know, we get the power over from the, you know, higher castes, but we use the same system to control people. And isn't it ironic that we have the 22 Hill Rajas and they're constantly saying that we are suppressed under the Muslims, we are suppressed under the Mughals. But isn't it ironic that when Guru Gobind Singh Ji comes along and he talks about the Khalsa, Baba Nanak's Khalsa, the fraternity of Baba Nanak's vision of, you know, equality, suddenly they unite with their most hated enemy to get rid of Guru Gobind Singh Ji. And does that indicate to us how revolutionary, how dangerous Sikhi is to that caste discrimination system?
Yeah, this is a perfect example when they have to decide between Mughal ruler or Sikhi, they are aligning with Mughal rulers. So obviously they consider Sikhi more dangerous than the ruler, because the Mughal rulers, there was a differences because of the tax revenue collection and all those. They feel that they are, but at the same time, their rule was guaranteed. The same way it happened in Britishers, where the princely states, if they are towing the line of Britishers, then they are their rule is guaranteed. So obviously, they in between, if Mughal ruler versus Sikhi, they consider Sikhi to be more dangerous to their very existence. So as I mentioned earlier, that once the principles of Sikhis are established, they see that it is it's this very existence which is in danger of Brahmanism.
So I guess from Bhim Chand's perspective, it would have been that if we keep on licking Aurangzeb's shoes, the emperor might be happy with us, allow caste to survive, allow our domination to survive. Another emperor might come and allow us more flexibility in what we believe and what we are doing. But on here, we have Sikhi, where, you know, Gobind Singh is saying everyone is equal, everyone has the equal right to arms, everyone has the equal right to, you know, live with human dignity. This is the greatest danger to us. We need to nip this in the bud. Who cares about the Mughals? And I guess this was the same sentiment which didn't allow the Rajputs to unite with Baba Banda Singh Bahadur, who obviously spent a lot of effort in dismantling caste all over India. So on that note, when we come down to the Sikh gurus, now, due to the recent events which have been going on, we have a lot of attacks being made on Sikhi on social media. And the chief main objective seems to be to divorce Sikhs from their own history. So the attacks I've seen, some of them misquote Sikh texts. So there was a very very prominent individual on Twitter, I won't mention him, and he posted a little excerpt from the Gur Bilas Patre Dasvi, saying, look, Gur Bilas Patre Dasvi never says that, you know, the Kashmiri Pandits went to meet Guru Tegh Bahadur. And then the same edition, Gur Bilas Patre Dasvi, was actually put up on a Sikh page, where they put the whole picture there, saying that actually it does say that the Pandits went to meet the ninth Guru, and this has been edited out by that individual. So one of their foremost attacks is that if the Sikh Gurus and the Sikh Pagats didn't believe in caste, why did they marry in their castes? How would we answer that?
Yeah, it's a very interesting question. And I'm in a process of writing one more blog which will deal with this. But we need to understand that fighting caste with interfaith marriages in itself a flawed idea. This idea has already is come yep. out of the so-called Swarn themselves, right? And it has it is happening to a very small extent, I would say, is there, and it is not helping. It is because it is not the solution. Marriage not only happens because of the caste, there are many other aspects. Even Punjabi would not marry with Marathi. Does this mean that we cannot sit together? No, the Sikhs have gone to Canada, UK, and all places, and have gained such a good positions in a decision. They are there in the decision making position. Are we trying to say that this they have done because they have married with the Goras and Kalas of those country? So this is a flawed idea, and it is not a solution to this problem. And then we ask this question, and then we get confused in it, right? This has also come out of our usual terms that we say in our society. One is the roti beti ki sanj, right? See, roti ki sanj, Guru Nanak did it by establishing langar, bali, sarovars, right? And by establishing new townships. Around 10 new townships were established by Guru Sahib, starting from Kartarpur by Guru Nanak to Paunta and to Anandpur by 9th and 10th Guru. These were done to establish so that the roti ki sanj, and to give equal opportunities to all the sections of the society, because the existing infrastructure in itself was not conducive to do this change. Now comes to this part. See, we living in 20th century, where there's a case of where the love marriages or have started happening. Earlier it was not so. So this was all has to be done as per the wishes of the family. And would you say that the Khatris, why they didn't marry with Brahmins, or there are, I know that within Brahmins they don't marry each other, some castes are like that.
I mean, from our personal perspective, as we were discussing it on our Facebook page, I guess the issues that were raised were two. One, if you see why the gurus did not marry in a caste other than their own. So the three perspectives, actually. One was that we are not sure what castes there are, you know, if we talk about inter-caste marriage, what castes their wives, their spouses would have actually been from.
Yeah.
If we start looking down from, let's say around Guru Ram Das Ji's time, because by then Sikhi had become cemented. On the other hand, if the gurus were preaching that, you know, there is no such thing as caste, because we are confounding ourselves here, because the Pagd said that there is caste, but there is no caste discrimination. There should be no caste discrimination. On the other hand, if you look at Baba Nanak, when Baba Nanak refused the Janiyu, now I don't know the exact word for it in Sanskrit, but he became casteless. And because he was casteless, scriptural injunctions held that whoever he came into contact with, they got the disease of castelessness from him. So whoever he actually touched, talked with, or, you know, even if a shadow fell on someone, their caste was destroyed. So when it's a question of the destruction of caste, caste would not have been the foremost issue on their minds when their life partners were chosen. You also needed, you know, conformity, dedication to the mission, etc., etc. And the third one was that let's just say that the gurus married into a lower caste. That entire mission they had would have become a personal feud then, because they would have been trying to, in a way, defend the lower caste spouse from Brahminism rather than deconstructing Brahminism itself. So they emphasized that over time Sikhs marry into lower castes, but they never did it themselves, because the risk of it would have been quite great. It would have transformed their mission of universality to one of personal feuds, of them trying to I guess we can say defend their rational when, after all, they were saying that there is no such thing as caste. Then why would they particularly choose to marry in a high caste or a low caste? Because they didn't even marry into a caste higher than theirs in the first place.
Yeah, you're right. See, probably this issue was not there at that time. So this has come up only late 90s. Right. So and now then we have started exploring our ideas of late 90s, why it was not implemented in 15th, 16th century. And one more thing. See, Ambedkar was married to a Brahmin lady. So how it helped?
Yep.
So first of all, we need to understand it is not a solution, because the marriage does happen not only on the caste. There are language barriers. So as the example that I gave you, that would you say that we need to Punjabis need to marry with Bengalis, Sikhs need to marry with Muslims, because both are we need to establish that they are all equal.
No, I understand what you mean. I understand what you mean.
So the yep. marriage has different perspectives.
And I guess another.
Yeah.
Yep. And I guess another issue down here, which has just cropped up in my mind now, is that if you look at the Guru's marriages, we understand that there were only a very few people who desired to marry their daughters to the Gurus. I mean, from the time of Guru Har Gobind Sahib Ji onwards, now look at it this way, that, you know, if a bachola, someone comes looking for your daughter's marriage to a guru, let's just say theoretically, you know, we put ourselves in Mata Gujri's father's parents' shoes. So they come to us and they say, look, we want to, you know, marry your daughter to Baba Tegh Bahadur, who is the youngest son of Guru Har Gobind Sahib Ji. And I guess one of the foremost things in mind would be that, you know, obviously given who he is, is there a risk that he would eventually be killed in
Obviously.
Battle? You would have to weigh up the risks of what they were doing. And I guess when you talk about the low castes marrying into the high castes, there was a lot of effort spent by the gurus into awakening the lower castes. Would a lower caste family have agreed
exactly,
in the first
exactly.
place?
See, one is the aspects that you are picking is very valid. That these are the social aspects of that time, right? The another thing I want to raise
yep.
is that is this actually a solution? Even if it happens, does this, because see, when we are saying marriage, we are actually, it's a patriarchal idea where we are saying that there's a problem in a society and this lady in our house needs to settle that by marrying to that person. This in itself has come out of a patriarchal mindset. Okay, an idea, a male-dominated idea of casteism, and a lady, a woman need to settle that by marrying to that and that place. So, and then because we know that, see, she will gain the caste of a man. So we are using women.
Yes.
We are using
yes.
women. We are saying that woman needs to now settle the problems that have come up because of the male-dominated ideas.
And I guess when Baba Nanak walked into a village, let's just say, you know, there are low-caste individuals down there, and he said, there is no such thing as caste. Even the lower castes would have been a bit taken back to hear what he was saying because it was so radical.
Yeah, yes, very true.
So we have to look at the contemporary fact as well, answering that question that, you know, it's quite surprising that the gurus got married in the context of the revolution they were leading, because they were seen as troublemakers and enemy number one of the state at
yeah,
that time.
Yes. And see, we know that our this history says that Guru Ram Das Ji, Bhai Jetha Ji, he belonged to a very poor family who used to sell Kunganiya in the streets, right? And he was picked up by Guru Ram, whether that at that time that was considered as a lowly job, but Guru Amar Das selected him for his daughter.
And I guess one thing down here is that Guru Ram Das would have been expected to be, I guess, from a better want of expression, a entrepreneur, a business owner himself, rather than, selling kongani on the streets and, trying to get by every day. So that would have also seen him reduced in the
Yeah.
caste hierarchy. So we have this issue. So we have the issue of, the gurus not marrying in their caste, which we have just answered that, caste never marry are mattered for them. And on the other hand, there were contemporary factors as well. So when we come down to Gurbani itself, now Guru Nanak said that, Gyan is the guru, etc., etc. So we come down to Gurbani. So the references to caste in Gurbani, like what the Pats do, that Sodhi Patshah, etc., etc., how do we interpret those?
See, it is when we say that Gyan is the guru, obviously that is the knowledge that has come out of from the Gurbani. So we need to ensure that whatever our ideas about, if we want to discard the historical chapters, yes, that is because we are not able to fit the Gurbani narrative into it. But then we need to see that it needs to establish, the new narrative needs to be established through a historical, a new historical facts. And Gyan is a term very frequently used in Gurbani, but at the same time it is also very generic term. It appears to be generic terms. So it is Gyan from the Gurbani. When we say we need to say that it is the guru is referring again in Gurbani, that it is the guru. We call it Gurmat, we call it the Gyan of the guru, if I'm able to understand your question and answer it.
Yes. So when we come to something like Sodhi Patshah, like Sodhi, we can say, well, what is Sodhi? Is it a caste? Is it a clan? This reference to Sodhi and Gurbani is another thing which is constantly brought up, that it's being referred to as a caste. I mean, I think Bhai Gurdas also makes a mention of it. So when we see this in Gurbani literature, that Sodhi Patshah, or that Palamar Das, how do we interpret those? So why is there a background mentioned in there? Is it to point out that these were individuals from high castes leading societies who decided to renounce their status and become one with the lowest of the low? Is it to point that out, that sacrifice?
So first we need to understand that caste has been mentioned for Bhagats also a number of times in Gurbani, right? Even there's a famous
Yes.
Shabad of Guru Arjan Dev Ji, where he very specifically mentions the castes of the Bhagats, like Gobind 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 Sang
Yes.
Naam Dio Man Leena, Aad Dham Ko Chhipro Hoyo Lakh Khina Rahao, Bunna Tanna Tyag Ke Preet Charan Kabira, Neech Kula Jo Lahara भयोगुनी गहीरा, रविदास ढुणंते डोर नीत, तिन त्यागी माया, प्रगट हुआ साध संग हर दर्शन पाया, सैन नाई बुतकारिया, ओ कर कर सुनिया, हृदय वस्या पार ब्रह्म भगता मैं गनिया, ए बिद सुन के जाट रो उठ भगती लागा, मिले प्रतख गोसाइया तन्ना वट पागा। एंड इवन द भगत्स दे हैव यूज्ड देयर कास्ट्स along with their name. So now the question arises that why Bhat have used the Sodhi and Bhalla? But first of all, ideologically, the caste has been mentioned in Gurbani of the Bhagats also. So what's wrong in mentioning that? Number two, important thing we need to understand is that Bhats came from a Brahmanical class. Now, it is only the Bhakts, but the Bhats in the Bani, those who have mentioned their names and the caste of Bhalla and Sodhi, and have mentioned the Guru. See, it's a very important development in the society that was happening. Guru otherwise was reserved for Brahman. There cannot be any other person who can be who can have become guru. So now here, what belonging to class is mentioned in guru. It's a very important development happening in the society, which is recorded by the Guru Arjan Sahib. So we need to see it from this perspective.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So the lowest of the low, basically, we were saying that the caste was underlined, then the status was underlined. That if you look at the Shabad in one light, that, you know, Kahe Ravi Das Jamara, that, you know, this is just them mentioning their own caste. But what it really becomes is more or less that, you know, look at what we have done, look at what we have achieved, that we weren't expected to achieve this, but look at what we have achieved in spite of the superficial distinctions which have been imposed on us.
This also needs to be understood from the perspective that these Bhalla, Trehan, Bedi, Sodi, Chamar, Julaha, Jat, they are the naturally emerging castes of the society. They are not made by Brahmin. What Brahmin has done has categorized them into Khatri and Shudra. So Gurbani is not rejecting the naturally emerging caste of the society. Gurbani is every time rejecting the Jat ka garb, the Varnashram. If you are able to dismantle the Varnashram, then the entire problem is resolved.
There's more fluidity in society, I guess, because as we can see, Baba Nanak took up farming because Baba Nanak was attracted to a farming lifestyle, but this was against caste. But because Baba Nanak had dismantled caste effectively, Sikhs throughout their existence have taken up various occupations without caste being a consideration for them. So we look at Baba Nanak. Baba Nanak has become casteless now. He's got this disease of, you know, non-caste, and he passes it on to Guru Angad, who passes it on to Guru Amar Das, and we have this, you know, non-caste disease coming down, down, down. It's passed on to their spouses. Their caste is destroyed. Coming down, we have Pats writing in Gurbani how these individuals from the so-called high castes have destroyed their own castes by becoming one with the lowest of the low. And then we come down to the late 1600s, particularly the late 1690s. We have Guru Gobind Singh Ji and Anandpur Sahib. And the culmination of this non-caste disease, this consequence of stepping outside the caste fold. So now it culminates in Guru Gobind Singh Ji preparing the Bata of Amrit, you know, giving it to Panj Pyares, who are from different castes themselves, predominantly the lower castes. And then he gets up and takes Amrit from their hands as well.
Very revolutionary step and very important chapter of Sikh history. It has many aspects. It has many aspects.
And we have primary sources which tell us that many among the Hindu fraternity, that they got up and hurled abuse at the guru and, you know, just stormed out of the Sangat at the time, saying that he's actually destroyed our own Deen Taram. He's spoken out against our traditions, our scriptures. So we have quite an aggressive backlash. We have battles. We have quite a lot of conflict around that view. But, however, after Guru Gobind Singh Ji obviously is assassinated, we also have the emergence of individuals like Kesar Singh Shibbar, who start bringing that Brahmanical thought process back into Sikhi. So today we have ended up at a sort of a crossroads where there is caste in Sikhi. We can't deny that, even though Sikhi is a religion of equality. Would you say that this was a conspiracy, like a concentrated attack on Sikhi, to dismantle it by Brahminism? All the, like, I mean, for example, Sikh texts like the Bansavali Nama saying that, you know, Guru Gobind Singh Ji has a, you know, the gurus have a affinity for the Shudras will destroy the Panth, or that, you know, Brahmins were the first ones to take Amrit, the Guru Gobind Singh Ji manifested Brahmin gods. Would you say this was all part of a very clever design, or was this a spontaneous reaction on part of individuals who were angry with the guru?
First of all, let me you mentioned this the Khande Bhatte, the incidents the Sajana of Khalsa. I've mentioned this in my book, Soul Enemy of a Sikh Brahmanism. There's another very important angle that we need to understand. That by doing so, you mentioned that the Ape Guru Chela, that the, now the Guru and Sikh, he established the, and he said that from where it was started, Shabad Guru, Guru Nanak started with the Shabad Guru Surtul Chela, and ultimately he decided to hand over this concept to the greater society. But now, see, there is another very important development which has happened. Earlier, the getting into religion was reserved with, first of all, a particular caste, whether it is in Islam or it is in Brahmanism. In Islam, it is not so, but it is reserved with a specified person, one person. Now, by doing so, he says that any Sangat need to select any five among you, those who are already pre-baptized, obviously. And first of all, it's five, it's not one. So the power of spreading religion now is neither with any castes nor with a single person. So this completely dismantles the priesthood if it is followed in this way. Because if it remains with the one person, then again he will become a person of a, which is, right? And if it is with the caste, it is the crude form of Brahmanism. So now he has done in both ways. Like, first of all, the authority is passed on to five, not to one person, and it is to general public. Now, coming to your second point, that whether it has happened with a strategy, I would say that it is by default. The person, those who are not into proper Sikhi mold, like in the discussion that is happening in our Sikh society, we are divided between various factions. And everyone thinks that he's right. So it's not happening through a design. The divisions are not happening through design, but Brahmanism in itself designed in a way that it... Once you are not totally on board on the principles of Gurmat, you will have a leaning towards the other side. It is like if there is no light, it comes by default. So the Kesar Singh Chhibar, whether it was by design, we cannot say, but we can say one thing, that he was not totally on board on the Sikhi concepts, right? And so there were preconceived notions on his mind, which he tried to, maybe he was giving that on Guru Sahib and he was writing those things, but he was not aligned with that. And so where he was coming from a Brahminical thought, that overpowered his writings.
And I guess today, in today's time, we need to be quite vigilant in what we are reading, especially texts like this. We need to have the cornerstone of Gurbani to measure them against that. Gurbani says this, so the Guru would have done this. So is this writer telling us the truth or not? But then we see that a lot of opposition is made to such an exercise. I mean, if anyone questions a historic text, there is a lot of controversy. So when this controversy is raised by a few individuals, is this just a way of preserving Brahmanism?
Very important question. This question is very dear to me. In our society, we need to understand that no one has the absolute truth. Okay, and what is happening, that everyone is sticking to my truth. That no, I have come to know Sikhi better than you. Okay, so there are divisions between Deras, Taksals, missionaries, intellectuals. We need to respect everyone. As I said, that the things happen by default. Let's say if I am more biased toward Brahmanism, even that may go wrong. I may try to justify. We have one person like it would not be wrong to name him, the Harnik Singh, right? So like he would put everything on the other,
yes,
other side, and he would discard everything.
Yep.
Right? Or put on the extreme right side, Taksals. Right? Those who are holding that, no, because it has been said by our Babas. Mm. It is written by our Babas, it can't go wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in between, how we can do this? We need to understand, okay, but the people, those who are attached with the both sides, they are not at any fault. If they are, because they are doing it from a Shraddha towards the Guru. Both are having a Shraddhas. Both the followers of these ideologies have complete Shraddhas. The people, those who believe in Hemkund, they too do it because of the Shraddha in Guru Gobind Singh. Those who reject it, they also do it. See, we reject it because we can't believe that our Guru has done like this. So both are having Shraddhas. Let us not question on each other's Shraddha. This is first thing. Now, how it can be resolved? It can be resolved once both the parties are there on a single platform, on single stage, which is not happening right now. It is not important that I don't agree with you, but if I'm not ready to listen to you, if I'm ready to give you a stage, that is the thing that is happening right now. And we are seeing that right now are major stages of the Gurdwara. They are in control of getting more and more in control of one ideology, which is aligned with Taksals, which is more towards Brahminical. And so they have space to speak up. Everyone has been divided into factions because they all are believing that my version of story is having more truth. But they are not listening to each other, and they are not giving opportunity to Sangat to listen to each other. So in one of my blogs, I mentioned to Jathedar Akal, Jaharpreet Singh, I've said, see Jathedar Saab, if anything that you can do is at least the stages which are there appear on TV screens daily by people like Bangla Saab Gurdwara, Manji Sahib, those stages needs to be there for all kind of ideologies. Let the Sangat listen what the other side is saying, and let the Sangat decide. And don't hold on those stages limited for a particular ideology. Sangat is deprived from the ideas what the other side is saying. If we are able to maintain that kind of
That's
thing.
That's right.
I think there should be no issue of having a different ideologies. Ultimately, all this culture will ensure that we all are merged. From my truth, we have come to oneness. This is the only way of transition. That oneness. Let us speak from one stage.
So effectively, the Sangat decides what's more effective and what's more true, rather than it being imposed on them. I guess one of the few questions we have now as we come to the ending time is that caste. Now, the higher castes always laid a monopoly on scriptures that, you know, only we can read the scriptures, only we can recite the scriptures or listen to the scriptures. Now, if you look at around Maharaja Ranjit Singh's time and the later Misal era, there was a similar bit of sentiment running among the Sikh, some Sikh Pracharaks who had their own institutes, that only we can read Gurbani, only we can translate Gurbani, only we know how to respect Gurbani. Then we have Professor Gurmukh Singh come along, Gyani Dit Singh come along, who looked at these translations, who looked at these Sikhs, and they sort of decided, okay, we aren't going to use this because they bring in a lot of mythology from other religions. We're going to use we're going to translate Gurbani through Gurbani, and the Sangha decided that their prachar was more effective than what had been going on for the past few centuries. Isn't Brahmanism a bit similar, though, that we have the high caste saying only we can use these scriptures, we can read them, we can understand them? And today we also have a series of Sikhs saying that only we know how to read Gurbani, only our way of Gurbani is right, only our way of understanding Gurbani is right. Isn't that similar to Brahmanism?
And that's what the intrusion of Brahmanism means. And the idea of having a Guru Granth Sahib or Gurbani in Gurmukhi was to discard this, that earlier all the religious texts in Indian subcontinent were in Sanskrit, and the knowledge of Sanskrit was reserved with a particular section. Now, what the Guru did, he challenged this authority of Sanskrit. No language can say that they are a godly language. We have Guru Granth Sahib and Gurumukhi, and the Bani of Magaths are in their regional languages. So that is actually to ensure that it needs to reach out to the masses. And another thing, at the time of Maharaja Ranjit Singh, there are a number of historical references where there are reports of Britishers where they say that the education level under his rule is among the highest at that time anywhere in the world. So we cannot it was definitely happened that even under Maharaja, the control was more or less with the Nirmalas, because it already happened during the Missal's time, when there was no time, or they were not able to control their religious places. So it left under the control of Nirmalas, and these Nirmalas got corrupted immediately once the Britishers took over. So the major degeneration happened after, because if you see this Kavi Santokh Singh, he does not belong to the Maharaja Ranjit Singh, he belonged to the Patiala Riyasat, who was more aligned with the Britishers.
Yep.
Right? So even his texts are also more towards the Brahminical side.
Yep.
So blaming on Maharaja Ranjit Singh does not justify. But yeah, so there were gaps which we need to address. It actually happened after this time, because the control was already in the hands of the Nirmala sects.
And I guess the last thing here would be that one more, I guess, issue would be that we have Gurbani and Gurmukhi. The Gurus devised a new script for Punjabi, and I guess this was done with the intention that the higher caste Brahmins would never learn a language which was different to, you know, Sanskrit. They would always hold a love for Sanskrit. And if they tried altering Gurmukhi, it would be a very big challenge. They couldn't alter Gurbani. The fact that we have caste in Sikhi today, there are so many people believing in caste today in Sikhi. We have multiple Gurdwaras based on caste in India and abroad. Is this because there is a salient disconnect with Gurmukhi and ultimately Gurbani on the parts of Sikhs themselves? That they go to the Gurdwara, do Matha Tek, and that's it. They never sit down and try reading Gurbani and understanding.
I would say it is not
themselves.
Disconnect with Gurmukhi, but it is disconnect with Gurbani Vichar. Because even if you know Gurmukhi, you're reading Gurbani daily, but if you're not doing Vichar, you will not come to know what you're reading. And that part is missing in Gurdwaras. And that is the worrying factor that have crores of budgets, but budget is being invested in marbles, in building, instead of establishing new school arts, right, which can be, they have, or writing a new literature, So, if that is not done, now again, is it happening by design? I think that no, this is not happening by design. This is happening by default because that's how the Brahmanism works. Because the people, those who are in control, they need to be in control. So they don't want the public to get aware. So by do all those things, and ultimately it is they will get the support from the other side ready to help them. And that is the Brahmical. Obviously, they get into Brahmism. So, see, one now to be more clear, why I'm again why I'm saying so different. See, that is because Brahmanism is totally based to leverage the fault culture, that is Kaam, Krodh, Loh, Mohankar. Okay, all those. That their beliefs, whether it's Lakshmi Puja, whether it is your stories of killing Rakshas, or whether it is the casteism, everything is to ensure that your Kaam, Krodh, Loh, Mohankar, the Devadasiyans, and all those, they are satisfied, right? To quench the thirst of your, they rather not to quench the thirst, rather to further put more oil into your innate faults, which every human has. And this ideology of Brahmanism is actually based on to leverage these things. So it's a constant needs to be constant contemplation that what I'm doing, I should not get towards these desires, otherwise, by default, I'll go towards that line.
So the need of the moment essentially is more education, more awareness, and I guess a concentrated of intellectual offensive against caste and Brahmanism itself, that this is Sikhi and this is that. Worlds apart, why are we doing this? And I guess that does entail a lot of sacrifice, that you're going against tradition, you're going against family, you're going against culture, you're going against a lot of things, but then you have the Sikh identity, the Nanakshahi culture to fall back on. Anyhow, thank you for joining us very much. We
Thanks a
appreciate
lot.
this. So your book,
The
yes, so
book is
your book,
available
where is it available
on
from?
Amazon, Barnes and Noble, and all online platforms. It's available. Ye Waheguru Ji Ki
Okay
Fateh.
then, Waheguru Ji Ka Khalsa, Waheguru Ji Ki Fateh.